The Naples of England by Andy Christopher Miller. Chapter 8. Pecking Order. When I was 9 years old, my father surprised me by agreeing to the conversion of half of our shed into a pigeon loft, an action forbidden under the terms of our council tenancy. The shed was partitioned with wooden struts, covered with chicken wire, and into the roof a trap was fitted, whereby bent lengths of strong wire allowed entry into the shed from the outside, but no return. The true wonder of this shed, however, lay in the homing instincts of its occupants. Other kids gave me pigeons from their family sheds, and I soon established my own collection of 5 blue bars and 1 red. I was told that they were probably home after being in their new coop for around 3 days, and despite fearing ridicule for my lack of patience, I risked my flock to the sky after 2.5. Not just to the immediate space where sunshine and light winds played against our own red brick walls, not just the line of rooftops curving away as Cheviot Road bent gently uphill, but to the whole sky, as vast as the estate and the town, and the open boundaries of the sea and hills that contained my sense of human scale and home. And they came back. Although I had shaken the corn tin, whistled and called while they executed their swift, swerving patterns between the houses and their joyous high arcs against the blue sky, I knew they returned of their own volition. Some perched on rooftops overlooking the shed for a while. Others delayed on the board outside the trap, jerking their heads back and forth. But they all stepped through the trap, the zinc-coated prongs rising across their shoulders as they entered, then falling shut with a thin clank behind them. I showered them with the corn mixture, spraying the floor with my gratitude. Their freedom and captivity. My beneficence and control. The greatest event, though, something which seemed unsurpassed in my life, was the presence one morning of 2 white eggs in a clumsily constructed nest box. The slightly built hen bird sitting on them seemed more alert than usual, and I willed these eggs to hatch, knowing from other boys that patience would be required for a full 21 days. When had these been laid? Whilst I was asleep or indoors eating a meal? Despite every warning about disturbing the nest too much, I checked these eggs for fractures a number of times a day, at breakfast time, after school, and before going to bed. When a small, chipped crack did eventually appear at the apex of one egg, I returned it quickly to the nest, but was back in the shed early the next morning. The crack had developed into fault lines, forming 3 sides of a tiny, ragged square. I held the egg, willing the moment when this tiny trapdoor would creak open. I imagined my own limbs being folded and aligned, compacted inside exact curved surfaces. Suffocation and terrible constraint. Too tight to breathe, too tight to lever any force against the wall. And then I snicked away the flake of shell with the nail of my little finger. Horrified at having interfered, instead of a chick bursting with a swagger beak first out into the open, in the tiny aperture I could see only membrane and pink underprepared life. I placed the egg straight back with the other, asked the mother bird to return to the incubation, and waited at the door until she did. After returning home from school at the end of that day, I felt huge relief at seeing a much larger hole and a yellow beak, new and shiny like plastic, and I left well alone. By the next morning, the baby bird, with sealed eyes and heavy, clumsy beak, was half out, sitting in the remaining shell as if its broad bottom were wedged inside the bowl. Both eggs hatched, and nothing in my days equaled the thrill of watching the industry of both parent birds, back and forth, filling their crops with food and regurgitating it into the open beaks of their offspring. Whilst the other pigeons strutted on their perches, even squabbled occasionally over ascendancy, and took the flights I offered them, this all now seemed perfunctory. The upturned beaks, the screeching at the approach of the parents, the unconsidered purpose in the short repetitive journeys, these seemed to me the obvious priorities of the community. almost from hatching, one chick grew bigger than the other. Blind, with only rudimentary stubble where their feathers would grow, their lumpy bodies were more fluid than flesh. The larger bird, at first, had the air of a protective companion, as both were squashed beneath the nesting mother's feathers, or were left looking out into the loft, awkward and lost, while their parents flew or fed. But within the nest box itself, a pecking and trampling order was quickly established. As soon as a parent bird alighted on the edge of the box, both necks extended upwards, straining and crying. But as they struggled, the larger bird more and more frequently pressed down on the other in order to stretch higher. Its creased and elderly-looking legs belied their dispassionate strength. The scrawny, elongated toes and their developing claws gaining purchase wherever planted on the body, neck, or face of the other. And the parents continued to supply the most prominent beak. After a week or so, the smaller chick, an albino, beautiful with all white flowers, was showing signs of weakening. It asserted itself less and less when a parent arrived, fell beneath the tread of the other more quickly, even looked as though its neck had less strength in the struggle for food. I removed the larger one at times and held it in my hands, hoping the other would thrive if allowed occasional, exclusive access to its parents. But this made little difference. Sustenance of a more fundamental nature was missing. Each time the claws descended and its face was pushed down into the straw, each time both parents continued to disgorge the contents of their crops automatically into one beak but not the other, the hideous differences between the two chicks grew. I tried removing the albino and feeding it milk through a pipette from my chemistry set. Its neck and wings seemed slack and unable to compose themselves. It seemed reluctant to open its beak. It choked and was unable to retain much of the milk. Back in the nest box, there was no alteration of routine among any of the birds, no compensations, no recognition. "It's dying. It's at it. You better wring its neck," other kids offered their advice, and I listened, especially to those with older brothers whose worldliness I admired. "Do you know how to? It's dead easy. Our Malcolm will do it if you can't. All it needs is food and not to be trodden on all the time." I knew this, but had been unable to have the slightest effect on the course of its decline. My parents did not know what to do either. I wanted to kill the bird myself, to do it swiftly and carefully, to be in contact with it when it died. The procedure had been explained to me. I held it as I would a larger bird, my forefinger behind the legs, the other three in front, cradling the stomach and restraining it, my thumb across its back. The small, slack body almost oozed between the gaps in my fingers. I knew what I had to do. Place the first two fingers of my other hand either side of the neck, then firmly and definitely twist and pull at the same time. One turn, or at least a quarter of the way round, further would be better. I felt its neck, the hopeless lack of strength, no sense of bone or structure for me to definitively crack and break. I was determined to be the executioner, to submit its body to one brief last act of violence and free it from the daily round of humiliation and abandonment back in the loft. Pull and turn, pull, twist and turn. I muttered the manoeuvres, holding the flaccid body and rehearsing. I was almost ready, one tiny instant away. Twist, snap and pull. The baby bird's death groan, a sudden gargle of bubbles in the throat, or a frantic final wheeze of breath. Twist and pull. What if I failed, made half a move and then panicked, desperate to repair the destruction? What if I did all I was supposed to do and it still didn't die, but instead the neck, more hopeless still, just dangled further down the body? I couldn't do it, pull, snap, done. I could not carry out this one quick, efficient act and become grown up, decisive and compassionate and unafraid. My friend said his father, who kept pigeons himself, would do it that evening when he came home from work. I made further futile attempts with the pipette, and it was still alive as I walked up later, alert to the rows of vegetables in the back gardens and a radio letting slip a pop song through an open window. I handed over the box, feeling abject and not able to say much. He saw it in me and said, "Leave it with me, son. I'll take care of it when I've had my tea."